This podcast is brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Keep Joy on air by becoming a member, a subscriber, or donate. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.
Good evening and welcome to The Informer. Well, it looks like we've been trumped. We'll be joined by Dr. Lauren Rose Warne, who is in Albuquerque as we speak. And a little later in the program, we'll be joined by Ian Daniel, who co-hosts Gaycation with Alan Page, to soon be on a brand new SBS channel. Well, it seems the impossible has become possible for Trump. He looks like the winner. We are joined by Dr. Lauren Rose Warne from Melbourne University School of Social and Political Sciences, who currently is in Albuquerque. Welcome.
Hello.
You sound a little deflated, Lauren.
Well, it's very difficult to put into words just how deflated I am, considering that every poll pretty much predicted something that was very different to the results that I'm seeing on the screen in front of me.
Is it a case that it's definitely Trump across the line?
We've got four states that still haven't released results yet, so that's Michigan, New Hampshire, Pennsylvania and Wisconsin. If she were to win all of them, yes, she can still win, but the margins are very close at the moment, indicating that that's probably not going to be the case. She might pick up one or two, but she's actually going to need to win four of them.
I believe that in this election, gender and race played such an important role like it never has before.
And yet, if that were the case, we've spoken for the past couple of days on the huge surge in the Hispanic vote. If that's the case, where did their votes go? And I think this is an interesting thing where we make assumptions about, you know, voting blocks, just like we do with, you know, the gay vote or the women's vote, as though all those people will vote the same, and it's not true. Hispanics are a good example of a very complicated voting block. For example, if they came here, let's say they were legal, in using Trump's terms, if they'd applied through the legal channels and had become naturalized American citizens, etc., etc., there's a hostility from them towards people who've come through illegal channels because they're going to be fighting for the same jobs. So when Hispanics are interviewed, very highly do they rate concerns around the economy. So making the assumption that they just vote Democrat because Democrats are less racist is a sweeping generalization that it seems probably hasn't played out here.
In fact,
about women.
In fact, one third of Latino men voted for Trump.
Yeah. And it's the same as women. We make this assumption that because Trump has said so many revolting things about women and to women, that women would naturally vote against him and for Hillary. It hasn't panned out that way. Assuming a female voting bloc is also misguided.
What has Hillary Clinton done wrong?
I think there's a combination of things. I think there's what Trump has done right, which is tapping into people's prejudices and giving voice to a whole lot of things that for 30 years were considered to be thoroughly politically incorrect to say. He's given voice to anger. So that explains part of it, and I think another part of it is that there's a deep-seated hatred for Hillary Clinton for a lot of reasons, I think a lot, which sense on her genitals that she was going to always have a difficult time running as a female candidate in the United States in 2016, which seemingly is not quite ready for a woman yet.
This means that Trump will have the Senate as well, that the Republicans will have both houses.
Yes, so things that we've got to look forward to, for example, is with that power, he can probably appoint one or two Supreme Court justices, which will give him the option to overturn things like Roe versus Wade, things like same-sex marriage. So they're just two of the many things that we've got to look forward to over the coming years, not to mention his promised wall.
And his lack of international policy.
Well, his lack of anything, because this is the thing. I mean, the guy is a complete liar with zero facts at his disposal because he doesn't understand the complexities of the American political system. So when he says things, for example, to the folks of Michigan, I'm going to force Ford Motor Company to continue to manufacture cars here, how does one actually do that? How do you force Apple to make all their products in the United States? You do not have that power. And yet, this is what he's promised those people.
Today, here on Australian television, former ambassador to the US, Kim Beazley, said if Trump got in, Australia would have to play a far more influential role in US international conversations and start to exercise some of its power that it's never had to do before.
Yeah, and one of the issues also is that Trump has pretty much shown virtually zero interest in Asia, in the Asia-Pacific region, totally. His focus is on things like Russia, Syria, etc. So there is also this argument that Australia is going to have to take a more forceful role in our region, acting as a kind of proxy. It goes back to the old rhetoric, you know, where John Howard envisaged the US as the world's police and Australia as its deputy in the region, God forbid.
This is going to play out in all sorts of ways. There'll be market fluctuations.
There already has been. There's been a big dip in the American and Australian stock markets. According to CNN, the dip in the US one is very similar to what happened post September 11. So that's a nice metaphor there, that Trump is akin to a terrorist attack.
What damage can he do in 4 years? There'll be another election in 4 years' time. What real damage can he do to a country, I guess, and extend that out to the world in 4 years?
Well, as I mentioned, the biggest things are being able to appoint Supreme Court justices, because that gives you, because of the way the separation of power is in the United States, Trump doesn't have the ability as one individual to change something like same-sex marriage or Roe versus Wade. The Supreme Court does, though. And just as the Supreme Court has decided in favour of both of those issues, if you stack the Supreme Court with conservative justices, you're going to see those things change. And that can easily happen within 4 years. The flow-on effects are that Australia and a whole lot of other countries are heavily influenced by the United States in terms of cultural values and trends in regards to social issues. So this doesn't bode well in Australia. You know, you've already seen Australians who articulate support for Trump anyway. This potentially gives other people in other countries, you know, the angry white male vote in other countries, justification for their anger as well.
I'm confused about the situation with Russia. Is this potentially a new diplomatic way forward between the two countries?
It is interesting because it's unclear, I think, to everybody what the Trump-Russia link is. Some of the speculation lies in that he's actually got financial links there. The other stuff is that, you know, if we take him at his word, he simply says it would be nice to be friends with Russia and have a better relationship than what they've had in the past. It's unclear. I think, you know, there is certainly, one could say that a friendly relationship with Russia could potentially be advantageous to the United States, given Russia's proximity to Syria, except for the fact the Russian government is incredibly, incredibly horrible in so many areas. Gay rights is just one of many examples where that's a pretty much totalitarian regime. So one would argue why the US would want to get closer to a country that we don't consider to be a good global citizen.
We're speaking with Dr. Lauren Rose Warne from Melbourne University School of Social and Political Sciences. If Trump didn't win, he was going to threaten all sorts of recounts and whatever.
I want recounts now too.
Oh, well, that was my question. Is Hillary in a position to demand the same?
Look, I think if in states, if there is a very, very close margin, and this is exactly what happened in 2000, where Al Gore didn't ask for the recount himself, the state actually just does it, because if the votes are that close, it's an automatic recount. So Hillary doesn't need to ask for it. It's done anyway, if the votes are that close. But it's not looking that way at the moment. We're not looking at, you know, a gap of 1,000 votes in some states, if only it were that close, but it's not.
What stands ahead for Hillary?
Look, given Hillary's age, she just turned 69 or 70, it's unlikely that she would run again, because this would now be her, pretty much, it would be a third roll of the dice.
He's promised to put her behind bars.
Yeah, well, look, the FBI came out 2 days ago and said that there's nothing there. So I'm not entirely sure what, I mean, a president, this is perhaps why he likes Russia so much, because in Russia you can decide you don't like your political enemy and lock them up. That actually isn't protocol in the United States, shockingly enough. He can't just look towards his enemy and say, I'm going to put her in a cage in perpetuity. That's not how it runs. There has to be grounds for a further investigation, and the FBI says that there's nothing there. It does raise questions, though, about, you know, agency or groups like WikiLeaks and their, you know, on one hand, they consider themselves to be agents of information freedom, but it's interesting that the leaks only affected Hillary. Where were the Trump leaks?
Is there any form of recourse there for the Clinton camp?
Look, I mean, this is interesting, isn't it? Because he didn't act, you could argue that the FBI agents, the FBI director, you'd have to make a case that he acted against protocol. Now, protocol does exist in, I think it's the Hatch or the Hatchet clause, that the FBI can't make public statements about investigations that could affect the outcome of an election within 60 days of that election. And clearly he did that.
Mm.
So the question would be, is that going... But, I mean, how do you prove these things? It's kind of like a court case regarding, you know, compensation for pain and suffering. At what point do you say that this FBI statement had, you know, did it affect 5% of voters? Did it only affect 2%? I mean, because you don't have the option to do a redo. So what... compensation would be appropriate. I mean, he might fall on his sword and lose his job, but it doesn't give her the election.
Sure. It is a brand new landscape, not only for the United States, but for the rest of the world. Do you think the divide in the US will be as pronounced as if it was if the Clinton camp got in and you had all of these Trump people railing against her?
Look, the difference with the Trump people will be exactly what happened when Obama got in. And there was a whole lot of people who decided that they weren't going to accept the election result. Too bad, you have to accept the election result. And now you might say, well, some of those, you know, aggrieved Trump supporters, well, they would be likely to be armed. Well, that's what the National Guard exists for. They get shut down pretty quickly. So I think in that case, yeah, there would have been unhappy Trump sore losers, but eventually they would have had to come into the party, you know, settle down, because it's happened before when Republicans haven't won and they've been aggrieved at the result. This time around, with Trump actually looking like he's going to win, it's in line with what's happening around the world. I think there's parallels that can be drawn with France, with Germany, but most certainly with Brexit, where people who are fearful in the generic sense, but largely of things like immigration, are articulating their fears in the polls. And it's changing the fabric of countries where arguably a lot of these nations were quite culturally sensitive, is probably an overstatement, but certainly multicultural and relatively harmonious, you know, in the scheme of things, are now not going to be. And they've got highest level justification for not being. And that's the worry.
Lauren, this, I believe, is the first time a candidate in Trump has managed to profit from his electioneering. He gets an allowance for the use of his plane, which has generated quite a nice profit for him, which is odd in itself. But along with those anomalies, we will have a new First Lady. Your thoughts?
So firstly, he's profiting from his plane. But this is where, you know, when when I've been doing interviews with people when I've been in the United States, people say, oh, well, at least he's paid for his own campaign. Well, no, he actually really hasn't.
He's invoiced.
He's rented out his hotel. Yeah, he's shifted money around, which is clearly what he's a master at, and rented out his properties for speaking events. You know, this isn't really making campaign contributions. That said, the very fact that he didn't do anywhere near the amount of advertising that she did highlights a really interesting aspect of campaigning in 2016. I mean, a good illustration of this is he didn't run a single television commercial in Spanish. Now, this is unprecedented in the last 20 years. Both sides of politics know that they need to target the non-English speaking community here. He didn't. He didn't run a single one. He didn't even have a mirror website in Spanish.
Wow.
What was that about? Because I evidently knew we didn't need it. It's extraordinary that it's just fascinating that what looked like, oh, you can't win if you operate that strategy, has actually been the key to his success. Now, as for Melania Trump, she's not going to be a Michelle Obama. And
sorry.
We're all going to think, we're all going to look back and think, well, I think for both Obamas, certainly what we've lost with them leaving, I think there's going to be a sort of collective sigh and disappointment. But, you know, Melania has promised that she's going to, what is it, crack down on cyberbullying, you know, and as commentators are asking, well, perhaps that starts at home with your husband. But, I mean, she seems to be someone who's a bit reticent about having a public profile in terms of a kind of public a speaking persona. She's not a Michelle Obama. She's not, you know, I mean, Michelle Obama has two Ivy League degrees. You know, we're not making an apples and apples comparison. I don't think that's necessarily a reason to condemn Melania Trump. She wasn't the candidate. I think that's just, you know, it's amazing that Michelle Obama was so wonderful, but we didn't vote. We shouldn't, hopefully, didn't vote for a candidate based on their spouse.
And finally, what does this say of Obama's legacy?
It's interesting because Obama's going to leave office with some of the highest opinion polls he's had in his entire term in government. But all that amazing campaigning that he did for Hillary, what does it come to? If his popularity and legacy was that high, why didn't it matter in the end?
Mm.
And I think this leaves us with a really interesting question.
Which certainly does, and there'll be many, many, many more questions to come in the future. Dr. Lauren Rose-Warne, thank you so much for joining us on The Informer tonight.
Thank you for having me on this horrible, horrible evening.
Dr. Lauren Rose-Warne there, joining us all the way from Albuquerque. She is, of course, from Melbourne University School of Social and Political Sciences. I'm Dean Beck, and this is The Informer. As of next Tuesday night, the Australian media landscape is going to be turned on its head. SBS 2 will relaunch itself as SBS Viceland. It is a TV channel, a whole station devoted to programming that has got more of a youth bent to it. One of those programs is called Gaycation. It's a travel show of sorts that focuses on LGBTI issues around the globe. It is hosted by actress Ellen Page and her best friend, Ian Daniel. Let's take a listen to the introduction of their trip to Brazil.
Ipanema Beach in Rio is the mecca for tanned, toned, speedo-wearing partiers, and then there's us.
I'm wearing shorts. That's a big deal.
Look at these. I think mine are whiter.
I don't know. I think I'm whiter.
We're arriving in Brazil at the peak of Carnival season, one of the most sexually liberated parties on the planet, to explore a country whose relationship with the queer community is complex and often extreme. It's a country with some of the most progressive equality laws in Latin America, but also has the highest LGBTQ murder rate in the world. So Ian and I are here to explore what's going on and what it's really like to be queer in Brazil.
That is Ellen Page, and the Ian that she was talking about, who stars alongside her in Gaycation, is Ian Daniel, and he joins us on the line. Welcome.
Thank you for having me. Appreciate it.
Ian, I believe Ellen pitched this to one of the owners of Vice, and you were then brought along as the offsider.
Yeah, I'd never been on camera before, so that was new for me for sure. I'd made documentaries and interviewed people a lot before. And I did a screen test in the streets of New York, really randomly, and it went well. And then they tried me out for the first show, which was Japan, and then that went really well. I mean, you know, it just came really naturally to me, I think, and... And then, the rest is kind of history.
This is a lot more than a travel show, though. You go to some challenging places as far as the LGBTQ communities are concerned around the globe. What's been the most challenging thus far?
Well, I mean, I just think there are like a multitude of challenges inherent in the show, inherent in traveling, inherent in entering different countries and trying to remain open-minded and just looking at the LGBTQ and queer experience there. And I think that, you know, it's like hard for me to say like one challenge, the most challenging thing. There's just... I think it's more about people there going through such challenges, and I think there are universal challenges of what queer people are going through all over the world. So no, that's a really difficult question for me to say quickly, I guess.
I guess for me, the thing in Brazil where you were interviewing a man who claims to have obliterated eight gay people, that's got to be confronting to meet a man like that face to face.
Yeah, I mean, if you're looking at challenges like that, yeah. I mean, I think there are a lot of times in the show where we're talking to people that don't agree with who we are or don't like who we are, would like to see us dead. That's definitely challenging to take into your, you know, to take into your ears and your body. And I mean, it's just an eye-opening, scary experience because that's what people are going through in these countries. And it's like definitely difficult to look in someone's eyes who's basically saying evil and sort of horrifying things. But in the same right, I think it's important that we hear those stories. It's important to really know what's going on with people and why. Like, it's important to really kind of dig into where hatred comes from and why people hate on each other and why anyone would violate somebody just based on their gender, sex, sexuality, or the way that they carry themselves. So just reflecting on that during those circumstances, yeah.
I think it also puts the challenge out to people in, you know, wealthy countries like the US, like Australia, who do have rights and who do have freedoms, to actually step up to the plate and start championing those who don't.
Definitely, yeah.
Tell me what your time working with Ellen, I mean, you're friends for so long, but what's it like to actually work with Ellen Page?
Yeah, I mean, we're great friends. Like, we have a really, like, special, beautiful friendship. It's one of a kind, and we're actually really amazing work partners. I mean, I just think we really see eye to eye. We challenge each other. We get each other. And that's just on a creative level. And then on the show, I think you see that our friendship is conveyed, that the power of our friendship comes through. And also just like the way that we interview next to one another and always reading each other's energy. So I don't know. I feel like, to be honest, it couldn't be more of a perfect fit of somebody to work with and also like have a really true friendship with.
It comes across on screen too.
Definitely, because it's very real. I mean, the camera's not lying. It's like very genuine, and we really care about each other, and we really respect one another.
I feel a bit awkward asking this question, but someone once said there's no such thing as a documentary. The fact that a camera is there, you know, a crew is there recording this, makes it, by its very definition, not so much fly on the wall. So how do you get that authentic space with people when you've got, you know, a crew with you?
Well, that's a good question. I mean, I think that, like, we all just try to calm down and be comfortable and, like, ignore the camera, right? And I think for me, I think my job is to, like, try to get people to relax and feel comfortable and feel like they can trust me with their story. And I just try to do that by certain ways of conveying body language or eye contact or speaking. You know, it's just really about, like, hey, we're here to hear you out. And we're also, you know, I'm gay, and I certainly don't necessarily know your struggle, but I can try to relate to the best of my ability. And I think for the most part, people respect what the show's trying to do. So they feel if they can just be themselves, and maybe that's the first time they're telling a story. Maybe they're actually risking their life to tell their story. And there's a lot at stake for a lot of people. And so you're just really seeing that genuine act of wanting and needing to be heard.
And there are countries right around the world where we see atrocities perpetrated against LGBTQ people, and they're on our TV screens and in news bulletins all the time. You turned the attention on the United States following the Pulse nightclub in Orlando. What was that like to be there after that terrible situation?
Well, it's obviously, you know, it's really heartbreaking. It's really sad and devastating and gut-wrenching, all these things. And also, it was actually uplifting to see how the community came together to support one another and try to make change globally, right? You saw how that affected everybody globally. I think Ellen and I discussed a lot whether we should go down there, what we have to add to the conversation. And we felt like the queer narrative, LGBT narrative, was kind of erased from the mainstream media. And we felt like we could give it more of a platform, and we could just go and listen to people if they wanted to talk. And, you know, we heard some really horrible but amazing stories, and really, yeah, we're just there to listen and to understand and how this happened and who it affected, and how people come together to mend one another, rebuild.
Have you come to any conclusions as to what or if there is a universal motivation behind the hatred and challenges that are thrown at LGBTI people globally?
Yes, I do think religion. I do think religion and politics come into play. I think that it's, you know, it's difficult to put it on one thing about like why we hate on one another, why we say hateful things to each other, why we violate each other's space, or why we act violent toward one another. I mean, it's like it's not easy to understand hate, right? Or intolerance or ignorance. But I think it's just about, you know, people are either raised in a way where they were taught to, you know, not like somebody that's different than them. And I think it's really just about finding a way to open people up to seeing the commonality in our humanity and even, you know, and to really reflect on why would you violate someone just because of their sexuality or gender expression or sex or color of their skin or any of that. Yeah. You know, why are we doing that? And I wish I knew the answer. We could fix it already.
Wouldn't that be good? We're speaking with Ian Daniel, who is, together with Ellen Page, co-hosts The Gaycation, which will premiere on SBS's new channel. It is Viceland. And Vice Media, Ian, is an organisation that has really put the challenge out to mainstream media in a big way. What's it like to work for a company that's kind of at the edge of pushing boundaries and creating a new space for media globally?
Yeah, I mean, it's really exciting to be a part of the Viceland launch in America. Now it's going around the world. I mean, I've always respected the work of Vice News and the immersive documentary style that they're so good at, and I don't know, it really shows on our show. We're able to get really amazing access to stories that it had a lot of heart, a lot of intensity, a lot of beauty, a lot of color, and so, you know, at the end of the day, we get a great show from them, and they work really hard to make it as interesting as possible, to reach young people, to make it different than your average news cycle. I mean, they really are trying to push boundaries. And make it interesting for people and get people engaged and moving along with the story. So I feel like we couldn't be more grateful to be working with them.
It's described as a youth media company, but at 45, I take offense to that, but that's probably more about me. But I think that the way they tell stories is quite amazing. Is the production team that works with you, are they particularly young, or are they just particularly dynamic and focused? What is it that makes it different?
Yeah, I think both. I mean, I think, I work with a lot of young people, researchers and producers, and you know, but it runs the gamut. You know, I would definitely call them young, you know, whatever that means, but definitely, yeah, they're smart. You know, I wouldn't call them kids, but they're smart and motivated. And I think the people that are especially working our show, we have a lot of diversity on our people that work on our show. They're really motivated by the stories, and they know that the purpose of it is something that they believe in. And so they're just putting tons of energy into it. So it's a very dynamic, passionate group of people. And I think that shows when you watch the show.
Some of those stories are quite challenging. Is there a sort of duty of care that you have to your interviewees? How do you put them safe and make sure that they're safe?
Yeah, I mean, there's lots of discussions around, you know, the ethics of what we're doing and how comfortable are people to share their story. Is it going to put them in any place of danger? You know, for a lot of people, it does, that there is a risk to tell their story on camera. And so we just have to make sure with them over and over again that that's something that they want to do, and that's something that we all talk about. So there are challenges with that, especially when you're talking about things that could get you murdered or really, like, that could get you thrown out of your home. And so, yeah, I mean, that's just part of the work, is always questioning that and challenging that.
In season one of Gaycation, you go to Japan, Brazil, Jamaica, and the final episode is the USA. What are you looking forward to in season two?
I guess I'm allowed to tell you. Season two, we go to Ukraine, India, France, Orlando, and then the deep south of the U.S.
Any chances of you coming to Australia in the near future?
I think that could be likely. I mean, you know, I don't know if we're doing a season three, but certainly we've talked about Australia. There's lots to talk about there, so it's definitely in the conversation.
Can you give us an idea of how long it takes to put together one episode? How long do you go to these places?
We're in each country for 15 days, and, you know, there's obviously a lot of prep time, there's a lot of editing, you know, things like that.
But is most of that scoped out for you before you get there, or do you have to do that when you're on the ground?
I mean, you know, yeah, we have a big team of people that are mapping out the potential things that we might do, and then we leave a lot of room for things to unfold in the air, and we really just allow the people in the country to tell us what they want to talk about and what is going on there with the LGBTQ movement and culture. Of course, we come in with some idea of the politics and what some of the attitudes might be, but we really want people to tell us from their point of view.
Well, I think Gaycation challenges all of us who have managed to secure some freedoms and rights. You guys have got marriage equality over there. We don't have it as yet, but marriage equality isn't the solution to all of our woes, I would suggest.
Exactly, yeah, that is correct.
Ian Daniel, thank you so much for making your time available to us this evening.
Thank you so much for having me. I appreciate it.
SBS Viceland premieres Tuesday, the 15th of November. That's next Tuesday. It goes to air at 4 p.m, but Gaycation is on Tuesday night at 8:30. Don't miss it. That's it for tonight's edition of The Informer. I'm Dean Beck. You can follow me on Twitter at Dean Beck On Air. You can follow the program at The Informer Joy. And don't forget, you can check out our podcasts by heading to Joy's website, joy.org.au/The Informer. Until next time, keep well. Take care. Bye for now.
Joy 94.9 is a GLBTIQ community radio station in Melbourne, Australia. Support Joy 94.9 by becoming a member at joy.org.au.
Thanks for listening to another Joy podcast brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Help us keep Joy on air. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.